Welcome to Dreaming in Color, a space for social change leaders of color to reflect on how their life experiences, personal and professional, have prepared them to lead and drive the impact we all seek. I'm Christian Celeste Tate, and I invite you to join me in these candid kitchen table conversations, where together we celebrate these leaders' ingenuity, are inspired by their wisdom, and learn how collectively we can all strive to do and be better. This is Dreaming in Color. Today, I'm sitting down with the Honorable Michael Tubbs. At the age of 26, Michael Tubbs became the youngest mayor of any major city in American history when he took the helm of his hometown, Stockton, California. As mayor, Tubbs was lauded for his leadership and innovation. Under his stewardship, Stockton saw a 40% drop in homicides in 2018 and 2019. It led the state of California in the decline of officer-involved shootings in 2019. And was named the second most fiscally healthy city in California and one of the top fiscally healthy cities in the nation. Mayor Tubbs is also the founder of End Poverty in California, or EPIC, which works to eradicate poverty by elevating the voices of people experiencing it and the data-driven policies that have been shown to work. Mayor Tubbs also serves as the special advisor to the governor of California for economic mobility. He's been on Fortune's 40 Under 40, Forbes' 30 Under 30 All-Star alumni, and was named Most Valuable Mayor by the Nation. In case all that wasn't enough, he's also the author of The Deeper the Roots, a memoir of hope and home. If you've not already read the book, I want you to put your shoes on, head to the bookstore, and listen to this podcast on your way. I'm so excited to be speaking with Mayor Tubbs today, and I invite y'all to join the conversation. Mayor Tubbs, you spoke for BridgeSpan virtually, I think, at the end of 2022. A lot of the perspective that you shared in that conversation really stuck with me on a personal level, let alone a professional one. So I'm just feeling very blessed to have you on the podcast.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thanks for having me.
Why don't I kick it over to you to share an invocation?
Yesterday, my good friend, the state rep in Arizona, he texts me. He's like, we're voting on a bill like they're trying to ban local cities from doing guaranteed income in Arizona. A week before that, it was Iowa. Last year, Wisconsin, South Dakota. It's like a really coordinated effort. And Monday, February 12th, I was in D.C. with some of the leaders in counties for guaranteed income, and we were talking about this. And I was reminded of one of my favorite scriptures in the Bible where the prophet Elisha, his house was surrounded by sort of hostile people who were against sort of what he was doing, et cetera. And his friends, his colleagues came to him very stressed. And then he said, "Fear not. For there are more with us than are with them." God, or some people might say the universe, had angels and other things helping to continue the fight in progress. So that's really been sticking with me this week, that despite sort of opposition, despite what looks like a lot of people are against, that no, actually, there's more people with you when you're doing the work of justice and are against you, even if it doesn't feel that way.
Yeah, I love that. And it reminds me of something we've thought a lot about here, which is the idea that it's not always clear what winning looks like. You know, when you're doing the work of justice and doing the work of equity, it can often feel like you're losing because those fighting against you are quite vocal and quite visible. But you might be winning that fight, even if it's just not clear to you in the moment.
Absolutely.
How have you kept sight of that in your day to day? Because I know the opposition you come up against is big in there and it's out there.
It's tough, right? But I've learned to really sort of hone in on the little things. In the case of the guaranteed income work, maybe it's meeting a recipient. Or traveling to a city and doing a conversation with the mayor and hearing from people directly impacted. Or maybe it's hearing from a college student. Like this morning, I did a podcast with sixth graders who are doing research on child neglect. Sometimes it's bigger. Like we just got some really good polling data that really surpassed even my expectations about the level of support for these things. Or it's my son saying, "Daddy, I like the fact that you help people." Or, "Daddy, I like the fact that you're trying to help give people money." It's like little things like that that keep me grounded, as well as sort of big seismic wins.
Yeah. And those seem really important because they seem to be all about telling the story of the work. It pulls me back to a quote that really stuck with me from your book, actually, about how storytelling is how we make sense of the world as it is. And it's how we gain the vision and courage to create the world as it should be. And I thought that was just a really powerful message. And it seems to play into these dynamics that you're talking about. Curious to hear more about how you think of narrative change and storytelling as being central in the work that you do.
I'm convinced that narrative change and storytelling is really the fuel that brings about any real change, particularly because America was founded on this myth of meritocracy, this myth of a land of opportunity. which is a good aspirational goal, right? But it just has never been that for everybody, at least. And we have organized ourselves, our institutions, our expectations of each other, and our laws based off those stories. And part of the reason why I started in poverty in California was because when I was serving as mayor in Stockton, I'm a nerd. So people thought I was just doing things just to be radical, but it was just stuff based off data. And I think it's an indictment in and of itself that acting in a data-informed way in our society built on myths and storytelling is actually radical. It's radical to say we don't have to lock everyone up. That if we looked at the folks who are most likely to be impacted by gun violence and talked to them before they shot, we could actually make the community safer. And that was radical. It was radical to say, you know what, folks don't have money. Mm. Not because they're dumb or lazy, but because they don't have money. If we give them a little bit more money, it unlocks a whole world of opportunity, which is sort of the thesis around guaranteed income. Or it was radical to say that South Stockton, where I was born, didn't have worse health outcomes because people were making unhealthier choices. It had worse health outcomes and a shorter life expectancy because the city planted less trees, because all the toxins and pollutants and trucks and warehouses were in that neighborhood. So to answer your question, I'm just obsessed with this idea of storytelling, because if our world operated, if our country operated based off data, almost everything we do would be different, from how we educate to how we work. Like literally we do the opposite of data. And what we do is operate based off these myths and these stories that come from popular culture, that come from religion, that come from myth-making in our history. And we say that, hey, in America, if you work hard, you can be successful. And the thing about the stories that the dominant narratives, I should say, that are told is that they're not 100% false. Like, I'm an example of, yes, in my case, working very hard allowed me to achieve some measure of success. But it's also true that working hard alone is not enough, because the hardest working people in our society make the least. So I've just been obsessed with this idea that I can't really have a policy discussion with you unless I change the story, because I can't talk to you about guaranteed income if you come from a view that people are strictly poor because of how hard they work or how much ability they have. Before I can even get to giving money, we have to have a conversation around how is that not true in all cases, and look at your life and look at your family, et cetera. So since being mayor, I've been spending a lot of time on storytelling with In Poverty in California, with Mayors for Guaranteed Income. In both organizations, we produce documentaries. One focused on poverty and power building in California, and one focused on all the recipients in all these guaranteed income programs. They premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, et cetera. We've done a writer's room tour where we've sat with writers and producers and showrunners to talk about, okay, how are we depicting poverty? Like, what's the story we're telling with the characters and the choices they're making? These stories are pervasive, not because they're incredibly powerful in that they can't change, but because they're not challenged. Like 7 years ago, the idea of giving people money in this country, no way. Just 7 years later, there's 60 pilots happening across this country using government dollars. We have HUD looking at, okay, instead of Section 8 vouchers, what if we gave cash? We have sort of the child tax credit, giving parents money just for having children, to help them with their children, being one of the most popular pieces of legislation passed in the last generation. The paradigm has shifted, but it's only shifted because we dared to challenge the story that people were struggling because they weren't working hard, or people were struggling because they were lazy. I think that's the work of justice folks, is actually just changing the story. Because once we change the story of how it came to be, then we're able to make sense of why the world is the way it is, to the point of your question, but also articulate a vision for what the world can be.
These changes that you're talking about are radical, but they're also simple, right? They're also rooted in the reality of the world we live in. They're also rooted in the data we have about the world that we live in. As you know, the theme of our season is reimagining our world and focusing on conversations with those normalizing what was once considered to be radical social change, right? Because these changes you're talking about, in some senses, they're radical, but in other senses, they're common sense. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how you get people to see them as common sense, and how do you override a narrative that's been around for centuries with one, even if you have common sense on your side?
It's an iterative process and still learning and trying, but if I was to distill it into a couple of principles, is that one, I try to make a macro narrative as micro as possible in talking with people. For example, this myth of exceptionalism, this myth that if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you'll be fine, which is a very alluring myth, particularly for folks who don't want to change anything, because it's not up to me. You need to work hard and particularly for people who actually are successful in spite of structural barriers. Like, look at me. I'm so special. I'm the one rose that grew from concrete. None of the other roses grew, but that's their fault. And that's why I wrote my book, The Deeper the Roots, to really sort of challenge exceptionalism. I think particularly in politics, you get elected because you myth make. You tell the story of I'm born in this amazing land of opportunity, et cetera, which is partly true. But I wanted my book to trouble that a little bit. I wanted to talk very directly about my own experiences and how exceptionalism isn't the right story. The right story is one of structural barriers. The right story is the tragedy that so many people, I grew up with so many people in my community, didn't have the chance to reach their potential. And the only delta was not working hard. Like there was there are a bunch of other things. Like, we shouldn't live in a society that's success is predicated by luck or by being one in a million. Number two, I think it takes being curious, right? It takes sort of just asking, why? Are we sure that's true? So it's not positing I have the answer, but it is positing that I'm not sure this answer is correct, or I'm not sure this is the complete story. And the scariest part is you just have to do it. I remember my first interview when we announced we're doing the Guaranteed Income Program. I was 27 years old. I didn't know nothing. I'm being challenged by like these Nobel laureate economists, political leaders, like the then vice president, very important people like, who have been doing this for a long time. And they were saying, oh, this incentivizes the dignity of work. And I was like, with all due respect, I just don't see anyone quitting working for $500 a month. I just don't see how that's enough money. $5,000 a month, they'll be dumb not to quit. Like, why would you see, if you only make $40,000, if you get $5,000 a month, no, you shouldn't work, do something else. But $500, that's not enough to make anyone quit working. And I was like, B, this idea of dignity being attached to work just seems so primitive to me. And I was like, well, wait, like, don't we want to live in a society where like our dignity is attached to our humanity first? And then we go to work and then our work treats us like dignified human beings? Because we keep saying dignity is attached to work, but then people go to work and work in undignified conditions, like no unions, terrible hours, no sick time off, no paid leave, et cetera, et cetera. And the first time I said it, it felt very scary. Like, what if I'm wrong? But no one had a real rebuttal. And since then, I have not been able to shut up on a variety of issues because I just think, and I think particularly for young people, particularly for people of color or women, other minorities or marginalized groups, you grow up thinking that the world is the way it is because very smart people figured this out as optimal and the best. And you're spending all your energy trying to make it in the status quo that you don't really have the energy or time to really interrogate and say, really?
Yeah.
But I think once you do that, you recognize that, oh, no. Like, the people who built our Constitution were smart. They're also slave owners. They weren't moral people. They weren't the moral authority of the world. Like, they were often patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
Many were rapists. Many were human traffickers. Like, this terrible people in some cases, right? I think once you recognize that the world we live in is the product of someone else's imagination, that may be your current nightmare, then I think it gives you courage to say, no, like, how do we create something different and something better and something more aligned with what we know to be true or what we know should be true?
What I love about what you're saying is the role of agency, right? And I think one of the things that's so compelling about your story and the way that you show up in the world is the amount of agency that you have felt from such a young age to be a part of those conversations. And I think it's an extension of exceptionalism that tells people that the world was built by people smarter than me. And it's somebody else's job or somebody else's power to go about changing it. And I'm curious from the organizing that you've done, how do you get people to buy into their own agency to change the world?
I think I approach it two ways, right? The first way is just a very sort of practical argument. The people who run things aren't impacted by this. So there's no incentive for them to change it. Like, the only way change happens is if you do something. Because other folks don't care. Like, they just don't. The only way this changes is if you change it. And even in your attempt to change it, you might not be successful. But I guarantee you this, if you do nothing, nothing's going to change. Because the folks who are in charge don't care about this issue the same way you do, or don't understand the issue the same way you do. Because that's what got me to get into politics. I realized that, no, for the stuff I care about, me waiting for someone to change it is going to take way longer than me trying to change it myself. I think that's the first thing. And then number two, I think it's just breaking down to people. In most cases, not all cases, but in most cases, them folks aren't smarter than you. They're literally not. Like, and I think, and I say that often because growing up, I really thought that folks with money or folks with titles or folks in power have like some inherent like genius. Like there was something, they know the right, they just know because they have the job. But that's because we've been fed this myth of meritocracy. Like, no, some people may have more access to information than you. You have to do the job to educate yourself and learn. But these folks ain't necessary, and some might be, but everyone's not smarter than you. Like your opinions and thoughts are valid too. And I think now that I'm not in office, just giving concrete stories of meetings I've been in, being in the room where it happens. I think First Lady Michelle Obama said this and was like, oh my gosh, like I've been in every room you could imagine. And most of the time, these people aren't that impressive. Like most of the time, these people aren't like Isaac Newton or Einstein. Mm. Most of the time, it's like, oh, really? I know more than you. Or
I know enough to speak up.
Yeah. Or my favorite line is, you can't be no worse than what we see on many things. Mm-hmm. Like at the bare, because that's when I was on city council as a 22-year-old. That was my mantra every day. Because the city had just declared bankruptcy. We had the highest per capita homicide rate in the country. And every day I would look in the mirror and be like, we have some big challenges, but I know one thing to be sure. I am no worse than the status quo. And that gave me a lot of confidence. I'm like, look, you can't get worse than this. We're at ground zero. Mm-hmm. So most things are going to be up.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think part of what I observe holding people back is the fear of failure that comes with speaking up. And that brings me back to something that you shared when you spoke back in 2022 with Bridgespan about finding what you're willing to fail for and then pursuing that without regard for failure. And I would just love for you to speak on that a little bit, because I found that to be so powerful.
After I lost re-election, it wasn't the first time I had been like rejected or I lost. I mean, that's part of life, but it was the first time in a while, frankly. And it was so public and it just felt so unjust because of how we lost and why we lost and the way people, not just in Stockton, but like Republicans across the country are like were really excited, which I thought was weird. So I spent some time like praying and thinking and just being really upset. But in a moment of clarity, I said, well, A, I'm 30 years old. So this is my, for most people, this is their ceiling. At 30 years old, this is my floor. Like this is the foundation upon which the rest of my life will be built. Wow, what an awesome floor. And then I said, And the worst thing that could happen happened. I lost. And it wasn't even close. It wasn't like I lost by 10 votes. You know, I lost. And it was clear that I lost. There was no, I couldn't lie to myself and be like, I counted the votes wrong. No, you lost, brother. So I was like, oh, that's the worst that could happen. And I'm still here. Mm. And people still care what I have to say. And there's still work to be done. But then thirdly, I said, and man, I am so clear now what I'm willing to lose for. Because I've done it. It was very explicit. And that's been so freeing for me in terms of the choices I've made, the things I choose to do, et cetera. Because it's clear to me sort of what my North Star is and what I'm willing to take a risk for. And I think that's a metric of success, to be honest, because then you know sort of the filter through which you can make decisions, the filter in which you could take risks, the filters in which you can use to really understand that your purpose or what you're supposed to do is actually not tied to your position. That your position is a means to purpose. But your purpose is not your position. So your position can change. Oftentimes it will change, particularly if you're trying to change the status quo, but your purpose doesn't. No, so I think that was the biggest gift of losing, actually, was just getting really clear. Because no one asks you that. Everyone always asks you, what are you willing to win for? Mm. But that's a different question than what you're willing to lose for, right? Like what you're willing to win for requires a different set of choices. But what am I willing to lose for? Like, what am I willing to do or try, even if I know I would fail? That's a different, that level of conviction is different.
I find that to be so powerful. And it goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about everybody having a role to play in this work, right? And everybody just needing to find the lane where they fit in and being willing and empowered to run that lane as far as they can. Part of what I want to do is try and paint a picture for our listeners about the world it is that you're building. You know, you're out here day after day for equity, for justice, eliminating poverty. Can you describe a world in the future in which you have met those goals and you've hit those marks? What does that world look like?
Yeah, we have glimpses of that world, like in our elite universities. Like, I think for me, I think of Stanford. I remember when I went home for my first break. It was Thanksgiving break. I went home and did a panel in my high school. And they said, what's the biggest difference between kind of Franklin High School in Southern California and Stanford? And immediately I said, there's no fights. Think about that. Like, the fact that there was no violence was like just mind-blowing for me. Because there are fights every day. But so I think safety, right? A place where people are safe. At Stanford, there was no limits on where your ambition could take you. If you had an idea, there was resources to do it, right? Like, so a place where your potential is met, a place where your basic needs are met. I remember telling people all the time, like, even if I don't like the dining hall food, I know it's there. I know what time it's there. And I know I'm going to have enough. I remember my friends would be stressed. I'm like, y'all, what are we stressed about? We're stressed about writing papers and reading books. And there's people I grew up with are stressed about Pampers and bottles, like literally 19, 20-year-olds having to like provide for a child. And we're stressed about five-page paper. So a place where your basic needs are met, a place where folks are able to try and reach your potential. And Stanford's not a perfect place. So let me move from that analogy, but also a world that treats everyone like how we treat some people, like a world without a hierarchy of human value, where no matter what the race or the nationality or the religion, we view the life as sacred, where the killing of some people isn't more alarming than the killing of others, where the erasure of some people isn't more alarming than the erasure of others, but the place that we see everyone as equally human, a world of second chances, basically a world for everyone, like in every upper middle class neighborhood. That's the world, like the same thing that most people that work at Bridgespan have. That's the world I'm trying to build for everyone.
Yeah, I love the way you shrug as you're answering that question, right? Because again, it's in many ways radical and it's in many ways simple. It's really not that complicated. It's difficult to get there and it's a complicated path ahead of us, but it's not that complicated.
I think part of it is part back to storytelling. One of the stories we tell ourselves is that other people don't deserve what we have. And again, I work incredibly hard. My wife works incredibly hard, but I don't think my kids deserve more. I think my kids deserve the world, but I don't think just my kids deserve the world. Like, I don't get any joy in the fact that my kids are going to have more opportunity than others. And I fight every day to change that. But like, I think so many people have internalized this scarcity mindset where I want what's good for me, but it doesn't bother me when other people don't have it as good, or I don't believe other people deserve to have it as good. And it feels radical in some ways to your point, but also feels just very not. Like, I want all kids to go to a great preschool like my kids go to. I want all kids to know that they have a place to sleep. All humans have a place to go home and lay their heads at night. I want all people to eat, not luxuries, but necessities. That's the world I'm fighting for. And some people might critique me for this, but I'm not even concerned about ceilings. Like, I'm not trying to, like, cap anything. Before we even get there, let's just make sure everyone has a floor. Like, I don't want them to talk about ceilings until everyone gets a floor. Let's make sure everyone has a floor. And then we can talk about how high it goes. But, like, right now we live in a world where some people have 10 houses and some people have none. That's wild to me. I think that's actually very radical, the fact that some people, because you're only one person. Some people have 10 houses, some people have none. Really? Some people have top schools and tutors, and some people have teachers that aren't credentialed in the same city, 10 minutes away from each other. That's crazy. So I think we can actually have an argument about effort and innate ability. But we live in a very uncivilized society currently where everyone doesn't have their basic needs met. So before we talk about this other stuff, let's just fix that.
Mayor Tubbs, I could sit here and talk to you for hours more, but I want to be respectful of your time. Let's go into these rapid fire questions. First question is, what's something that is considered radical but shouldn't be?
Ending poverty.
What's something that's bringing you joy currently?
My kids.
Best rapper of all time?
Pop? Yeah, Pop. Let's go with Pop.
That was the first one that had you thinking. You dropped the J. Cole reference in your book. I was kind of hoping you were going to give that one to Cole. Who's an artist you have on repeat now?
I'm very basic. So like Cole or Drake.
What's your go-to hype song?
Go-to hype song, man. Oh, Dreams and Nightmares, I think. Yeah, Dreams and Nightmares. I'm trying to get really hype for something.
And last question is, what are you dreaming of?
A better future for us all.
Well, Mayor Tubbs, I can't thank you enough for joining us here. I'm inspired by you and I appreciate you a lot.
Thank you, brother. No, thanks for having me.
My conversation with Mayor Tubbs left me thinking about what it really means to reimagine our world. I believe that that work is first and foremost an exercise of imagination. In order to shed the systems that do not serve us, we must first build the community and the creativity to imagine systems that will. And once we've built that imagination, all it takes is the courage and the agency to see that the rest has always been up to us. It brings me back to an Angela Davis quote, that regimes of racial segregation were not disestablished because of the work of leaders and presidents and legislators, but rather because the fact that ordinary people adopted a critical stance in the way in which they perceived their relationship to reality. Social realities that appeared impenetrable came to be viewed as transformable, and people learned how to imagine. We have to learn how to imagine a world that is defined by abundance rather than scarcity, by community rather than individualism. If we wait to be led to a better future, we may never see it, because that work doesn't start in congressional chambers or smoke-filled rooms. It starts at the kitchen table of ordinary people daring to believe, daring to imagine, daring to inspire. Thanks for listening to Dreaming in Color. A special shout out to the folks who make it happen. Our wonderful show producer, Denise Savas, our creative director, Ami Janay, our video editors, Jenny Liu, Stephen Chaya, and Dave Clark McCoy, our graphic designer, Diana Jimenez, our audio engineer, Teresa Buchanan, and a huge shout out to our ever-brilliant Bridgespan production team, Darren Isom, Cora Daniels, Christina Pistorius, and Ryan Wenzel. What a squad, y'all. Be sure to rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Catch you next time.